It's Tuesday, May 16th. What if you threw a border crisis and no one came? We start here. After planning for a surge in migrants, border officials are actually seeing a drop in crossings.
They're willing to be patient right now and follow the new rules.
Our team is on each side of the border to figure out why. Ukraine fights back to reclaim its city, but could it be getting help from the Russians inside?
Potentially give up the positions of regular Russian military.
Regardless of explosive reports, there are very real battles happening. We'll take you to Kyiv. And diet soda ain't good for your diet.
In the brain, in our reward center, anything sweet acts the same.
A major report says even sugar-free comes at a cost. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. For the last 3 years, Title 42 has been seen as a way the U.S. could keep migrants from crossing the border. Remember, this was the rule originally enacted as a pandemic health measure, saying we can turn people away from the border. The normal rules of accepting asylum applications don't apply when you're in a pandemic. When President Biden took over, he kept that in place. Cynics said, well, yeah, the moment it ends, people are going to come running across. Why add a border crisis to your list of headaches?
My administration is taking several steps to stiffen enforcement for those who try to come without a legal right to stay.
When the Biden administration did announce the policy was ending, Republicans pounced, saying he was basically assuring a crush of humanity was about to come across the border with no plan.
At what point are you going to take this seriously?
The chaos on our southern border continues to accelerate.
If you think things are bad now, they're going to get worse come May the 11th.
And yet, as Title 42 did expire late last week, and older rules called Title 8 went back into place, nothing really seemed to happen. There was no massive caravan rushing the border gates. People weren't climbing fences in record numbers. In fact, after a few days, Border Patrol is now reporting crossings are down. So, what's going on? Let's take you to Brownsville, Texas, right across the border from Matamoros, Mexico, a major crossing. ABC's Will Carr is there. And Will, I mean, what are you seeing there?
Well, Brad, as you know, there were a lot of opinions about what was going to happen post-Title 42. Leading up to it, some of the loudest voices really did believe there was going to be a massive surge.
We are witnessing an absolute travesty.
Senator Ted Cruz was here the day that Title 42 was expiring, and he was saying there was going to be an invasion.
This is a decision that was made by President Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and congressional Democrats to open up the border to what is nothing less than an invasion.
And what has actually happened is the exact opposite.
We have been preparing for this transition for months and months.
Over the weekend, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas came out and said there'd been a drop by 50% in border crossings.
We have to incentivize the use of the lawful pathways and disincentivize placing people's lives in the hands of smugglers, and we are doing that.
Encounters at the border have dropped from about 10,000 per day in the days leading up to Title 42 expiring to 4,200 on Saturday, more than 50%. So a drastic drop in people coming to the border.
And just so I'm clear, this is not just like you're at a place where it doesn't seem to be hopping, right? This is border-wide. This is what like federal officials are saying.
That's exactly right. More than a 50% drop across the border. Now, specifically where we are, I can tell you that leading up to Thursday night, so Title 42 expired at 11:59 Eastern, there was a rush.
People crossing here every single hour, going up that hill, over the barbed wire, and they can't go any further. U.S. authorities making them wait there, sometimes for days.
In the days afterwards, and especially over the weekend, it almost became a ghost town of sorts, comparable to what we were seeing with the migrant flow coming in before Thursday.
Everybody here is trying to get on one of those buses.
Here in Brownsville, we definitely felt that. There's fewer people in the streets. There's a welcoming center in the heart of downtown, and we were seeing fewer and fewer migrants show up to that welcoming center, realizing that there had been a lack of people coming across in the days post-Title 42.
And why is that, Will? Because you actually spoke to some people who are contemplating crossing, right?
I actually went over to Matamoros in Mexico. There's a massive camp there, more than 1,500 people who have been there, some for months, some for weeks, some for days.
De donde eres?
Venezuela.
Venezuela?
We went over there to talk to them about why they have not crossed yet.
Si Dios me lo permite, si
the majority said that they're willing to be patient right now and follow the new rules. Part of the new rules are that if you're coming from a country that's not Mexico, you have to apply for asylum in a country that you came through and be denied before you can apply for asylum in the United States. The other thing is that you have to apply through an app called CBP One for an interview to get asylum. If you show up to the border, you're going to be turned around. You need to apply for that app. So the migrants in Matamoros tell us that they're trying to follow these rules. Now, I want to set this up for you because they are living in squalid conditions. More than 1,500 people, they're living in makeshift tents. Some were cutting tree branches while we were there and setting up their tents with tarps and tree branches. We had tornado warnings in this area over the weekend. There was terrible rain. It's also been hot. It's been muggy. I mean, these are terrible conditions to be trying to survive in while you're trying to figure out exactly how you're going to make it into the United States.
Some of the women here tell me they've been here for about a week and they've already been robbed multiple times. They are terrified.
So that's the reality of the situation that's happening just across the border.
Wait, so that's where you're being told, like, get out your smartphone. Hope your smartphone has a charge. Like, make sure you use the app.
That's right. And they tell us inherently there's problems with that. First of all, the CBP One app has had some glitches. Then also large swaths of the border don't have great cell service, including Matamoros. So
right.
Some of the migrants are telling us that they can't get the app to even work. So they're trying to figure that out. They're trying to figure out they're trying to weigh how much faith they have in the system right now versus their desperation to try to get into the United States. And they are quite literally only split by the Rio Grande between Mexico and the United States. And they are staring at the United States every day, trying to figure out what their move is. But for right now, they appear to be patient and appear, so they tell us, to be trusting the system.
Well, and for right now, I think is a key term here, because what I'm still trying to understand is Title 42 goes away. And if sort of this weekend's data was to be believed, you'd be like, wow, Title 42 didn't do what everyone thought it was. Title 8 actually is keeping more people out. Is that true? Or are people just kind of wrapping their minds around it and they will come over soon? It's just not, maybe just not right now.
So when you talk to the migrants, they're concerned because they've been told that if they do this the wrong way, they won't be able to apply for asylum again for 5 years.
Like, that's resonating, that five-year thing.
Yes, that is hitting them, so they don't want to make a mistake with this process. So the argument has been that these are stricter penalties coming out of Title 42. Now, the ACLU is now suing the Biden administration, comparing these new policies to Trump era immigration policies, which the administration is pushing back on. They're saying they're not apples to apples, but the migrants are listening to that. And that is a real penalty that they do not want to run into when they're trying to make it into the United States. So even those who are living in squalid conditions who we spoke with say they're willing to wait right now, hoping that the app, that the process will work for them so that they can come into the United States legally and try to pursue their life here. Many have family members all across the country.
Really interesting. All right, Will Carr there in Brownsville, Texas. Thank you so much.
You bet, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the battles on city outskirts are one thing, but there could be battles within Russian leadership. We go to Kyiv after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
For the last few days, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was on a kind of European tour.
Slava Ukrainian!
Visiting world leaders, asking for money, weapons, support. He got a lot of what he was asking for. But some of his most welcome news might have come from the home front in the last couple days. ABC's foreign correspondent Tom Sufi Burge is in Kyiv, Ukraine right now. Tom, the city everyone's been talking about is Bakhmut, right? The town in the eastern part of this country, in the Donbass region. I think Russia had taken it over. I mean, seeing this new footage, is Ukraine about to get it back?
The simple answer to that is no, Brad.
Okay.
I mean, look, okay, Bakhmut is this fairly inconsequential city. I mean, it's not a huge place. Even before the war, it was sort of 80,000 people. Russia has been trying to capture that for 9 months. It has gradually been pushing Ukrainian forces back. According to US officials, Russia has lost thousands of troops in a very, very bloody battle. And they've pushed the Ukrainians right to the western edge of that city. What's happened in the last few days is that the Ukrainians have seemingly exploited Russian weaknesses on the edge of that city. It's possible the Russians have effectively overstretched themselves, and the Ukrainians have managed to take relatively small areas of land to the north and south of this city. But, I mean, if you watch this body cam video which is circulating, it is incredible. It seems to be a pretty well-coordinated operation by the Ukrainians. Tanks, armored vehicles, and they basically rout the Russians in these areas. It is highly significant. It's hard to know whether this is a crucial turning point in the war, but it points towards a potential change in momentum.
Yeah, does that change in momentum as in, like, are we witnessing a counteroffensive right now where, you know, the story of the winter is Russia pressing where it can, Ukraine defending where it can, and now this changes, or are we not there yet?
Well, I mean, look, this is the sort of key question that journalists like us are trying to answer. I think it's too early to say definitively whether this is the beginning of the counteroffensive.
We really need some more time, not too much.
President Zelensky in the UK saying to journalists, no, the counteroffensive hasn't begun yet. My troops need a bit more time, were his words. But I think we're now into a phase where the Ukrainians have got a lot of the military equipment, the tanks, the armored vehicles. They've got longer range missiles now. A lot of that is in country. A lot of it, I think, is now probably in the sort of battle zone. We're now in a guessing game, and the Ukrainians need the Russians to be guessing, right? This is the whole idea. There's psyops, there's lots of messaging, confusing messaging floating around.
I just don't want to prepare, not for our friends. There are no secrets from our friends, but there are some secrets from our neighbors.
Is this the beginning of the offensive? It could be. It has to develop a bit more on the ground. And I think one key point for people, they need to realize that we think of this counteroffensive suddenly beginning, a big bang moment. It probably isn't going to happen like that. It's probably going to build. The Russians are dug in along that front line. It's a very long front line, about hundreds of miles long. You know, the Ukrainians are nibbling away at it. They're probing and looking for weaknesses and trying to exploit those weaknesses and hoping that they can try and move forward.
You mentioned exploiting weaknesses, right? Dividing and conquering. Some of the drama that's caught my attention in the last few days are these reports that there might be dissension on the Russian side in this very city of Bakhmut. We've seen reporting that the sort of mercenary military group that's been really helping there might not be on board with President Vladimir Putin. What's going on?
Well, look, I mean, look, for months, there's definitely been division between this mercenary group called the Wagner Group, run by this oligarch close to Putin, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and the regular Russian military run by the Russian Ministry of Defense. I mean, look, Prigozhin and his men have been heavily involved with the fight in Bakhmut. And Prigozhin is a loose wire. I mean, he is a very colorful character. That's an understatement.
Prigozhin angrily blamed Russia's defense ministry, accusing it of starving Wagner of ammunition as part of a long-running feud between him and Russia's military leadership.
He comes out with wild statements on social media. He's criticized the Russian military for not giving his men enough ammo. And now we've got this pretty incredible story appearing in the Washington Post. I mean, the Washington Post are saying they've got a leaked classified document, part of these Discord leaks, the trove of documents, supposed US intelligence documents, which appeared on this gaming website. And this document apparently suggests that Prigozhin, the head of this mercenary group, has been contacting Ukrainian military intelligence and offering to the Ukrainians to potentially give up the positions of regular Russian military in return for allowing his troops in and around Bakhmut to take territory. Now,
we'll tell them where Russian forces are just because, like, we're mad at the Russian leadership? That you'd do that?
I mean, look, I find this story incredibly hard to believe. I don't doubt the Washington Post have got this document. I think the context to this is a crucial moment. You've got to remember, this is also an info game. Right? You've got troops on both sides. They're sitting in their trenches. They don't know where the next attack's coming. And part of the game is also to sow disinformation. The Russians are experts at that. We've seen it for years in Ukraine. They tell lies on a constant basis. And the Ukrainians are not completely white either on this in terms of propaganda. They're fighting a war for their survival, and therefore they are spreading misinformation too. I'm not saying for sure this story is misinformation, but that's the way it seems from where I'm sitting.
Really interesting. All right. Tom Sufi Burridge there in Kiev. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
When I was like 20 years old, I'm at the dentist and my dentist asks me how much soda I drink. And I say, oh, like 2 or 3 cans a day. He was horrified. For one, my dentist said, it's so sugary, terrible for your teeth. Two, he said, it's carbonated. So think about it. It's like little citric acid explosions bursting against your enamel. But three, my dentist said, that much regular soda is just bad for your body. Like, at least drink diet instead. Well, yesterday, the World Health Organization came out and said those zero-calorie sugar substitutes you thought might help keep pounds off? Not so much. ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, has a degree in nutrition and is board certified in obesity medicine. So, Dr. Ashton, you're the person to ask. I've been drinking diet soda now for like 15 years. Am I slowly rotting away?
Yes, Brad. So, listen, this is the interesting nugget in the world of nutritional science. For a while now, we've been tracking the popularity of these non-sugar substitutes because they are everywhere, right? And they have been for decades. And we're trying to see, how do they work in the brain? How do they work in the body? How do they work in the gut, the GI tract? How do they work in your mouth for oral health? And then the associated long-term targets, how do they work in terms of their links with things like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, various types of cancers? And I have to tell you, Brad, it's not good. And yesterday, the World Health Organization came out with, you know, a real edict, if you will, about these non-sugar sweeteners and said, guess what, folks? There's no benefit to using them when it comes to the outcome of long-term weight loss and .. They may also be not so good when it comes to the other things that we are all trying to avoid as we work our way through our lifespan, which is type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and various types of cancer, all of which are linked with the conditions of overweight and obesity.
That is so interesting that not just weight gain, but also some of these, you know, lifelong conditions that you can have. What kind of foods and sugar substitutes are we talking about? Like, can you just help? I think of diet soda, but I mean, what is the realm here?
Well, you're right. We're talking about things like diet sodas, various drinks, but we're also talking about things when you turn that package around and you read the label, have added sugar in high amounts. So these can be sugar substitutes like stevia, but it can also be things like saccharin and anything that tastes sweet in your mouth, sucralose, aspartame, all of those things. If you look at them, they have a certain appeal, usually for, let's say, their calorie count or the way they spike your blood glucose or the way they affect the GI tract. But guess what? In the brain, in our reward center, anything sweet acts the same, and that is, it makes us want more of it.
I see. Because I was going to say, like, I don't get why I would get, you know, type 2 diabetes because of the sugar substitute. If it's the chemical itself that would cause a problem, or it sounds like you're saying it's more like it's convincing my brain that I need more of these other unhealthy foods in my diet, and that's what ends up causing the weight gain or perhaps even diabetes.
One of the things that we've seen, not just in nutritional science literature, but in our day-to-day lives, right? We reach for a diet soda that may have zero calories or a diet iced tea that may have zero calories. But then in our brain, we do some quick math and we say, oh, so I can have more fries because I have zero calories over here. So I'll take more in this hand. And so people wind up getting into a lot of trouble when they use this as a supposed weight loss tool. Not always, but a lot of the times.
Well, and we should say the FDA has deemed most of these products you're describing as safe. So what do I do? Like, just don't drink anything? Just drink water and eat water? Just water's the only thing I eat now?
Get your calories from the sun, just like a plant. Right. Photosynthesis. I encourage people to think of this almost like they're balancing a checkbook or a bank account. You want to keep in mind your maximum allowed added sugar per day, which as set forth by the World Health Organization is 25 grams of added sugar a day maximum if you're a woman, 36 grams maximum per day if you're a man. So people oftentimes will make the analogy of, well, how many teaspoons is that? Most people, I want to be clear, are not dumping teaspoons of sugar into their foods. It's in bread and ketchup and yogurts and things that we think are kind of healthy, but at the end of the day, we're well over that 25 grams or 36 grams. So my advice to you, Brad, turn those packages around, look at that line, added sugar, and just keep a mental tally in your head. Remember, 36 grams a day if you're a man. So if you pick up a nice Greek yogurt that you think is so healthy, which it can be, and it has 21 grams of added sugar in it, and that's your breakfast, you're going to be over by the end of that day. So just keep an eye on those numbers. Of all the numbers on the back of a nutritional package, I think right now we're in the heyday of added sugar is having its moment. That's the star of the day.
Yeah, and it sounds like essentially you're saying if your day-to-day diet is just sweet through and through, like if you're just constantly eating sweet, 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 regardless of the calories in each of those things, it then creates habits that would actually make losing weight difficult and crowding out some of the other nutrition you would be taking in because you're spending all your day on this empty stuff. All right, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, no one upstages them unless there's a writer's strike. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Some like it hot, but most of them don't like crossing picket lines. This year's Tony Awards, which honor the best in Broadway, were slated to be held in June, but because of the writer's strike, familiar story, they've been given the hook. When you think of Broadway shows, they don't rely on the WGA, but the Tony Awards itself is a telecast, so of course, it does. WGA writers create the jokes, the banter, the big splashy CBS show open.
Life were more like theater. Life would.
Last night, Tony producers scrambled to convince the WGA to give them a waiver, effectively saying for this one show, the strike doesn't apply, which they have done before during a strike back in 1988 when Angela Lansbury hosted.
We are allowed to travel as far as the reaches of our imagination.
How important is this telecast? Well, in a given year, about 13 million see shows on Broadway, 13 million total. The viewing audience for the Tony Awards last year was close to 4 million people. That's almost a third of all Broadway ticket holders. Now, not all those viewers are going to go to New York and buy a ticket, but in comparison, the leading contender for Best Musical, the adaptation of Some Like It Hot, has only been seen by 250,000 people thus far.
Some like it hot and hot is what I got for you.
Meaning, if a fraction of TV viewers want to see that in person, boom, you just doubled your revenue. Which is what makes a strike like this so complicated. You talk to writers, They want theater to succeed. You talk to actors, they obviously want theater to remain healthy, but they're not going to cross a picket line to attend an award show. Well, late last night, after an emergency meeting, the Writers Guild reportedly decided not to picket the event, meaning the June 11th show can conceivably go on. And the union hopes seats will be full enough to assure that everyone on Broadway still has a job next year. And by the way, just so I'm not playing favorites, the other new musicals to keep your eye on here: Kimberly Akimbo, New York, New York, Shucked, and the show End Juliet. So now you can sound cultured on June 11th when you know the nominees. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.